Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 2nd. Today's session is Global Climate Change, Truth and Consequences, The Morass, Economic and Policy Dimensions of Climate Change, presented by Philip Moat. Number of the tape is 2002-04. Let's listen in.
Apparently they tape all the sessions and keep them for decades, so. We've been, for those of you who haven't been to all of the sessions, we've been looking at this problem of global climate change. Actually, I think all of you have, nearly all of you have. We're starting to recognize faces. We've been looking at this problem of global climate change, and we're now in the fourth of a series called The Morass, Economic and Policy Dimensions of Climate Change. Oh, I just lost my remote control. Here he comes. Next, please. Thank you. Okay, so here's where we've been. Monday, the question was, are humans changing global climate? Tuesday, looking into the future, what impacts would it have? Wednesday, yesterday, we talked about moral and ethical dimensions. Today, it's economic and policy dimensions, and then tomorrow morning, we get the hopeful message that this is actually a problem that we can solve if we put our minds to it. I'm going to briefly run through the main points of the previous talks, in case you weren't there or fell asleep. Then I will talk about policy goals in the 1990s. What was the attempt of the international community to grapple with this issue, and some of the history of that. And then finally, I'll talk about economic analyses, meaning people running economic models to say how bad it would be if we tried to do something about climate change. So, previous talks, Monday, the main message, yes, indeed, science has pretty well concluded Earth is definitely warming, and probably, with likelihood of something in the neighborhood of 66 to 90%, probably humans are responsible for the warming we've seen. Wednesday, I talked about projections of future climate change that unless we make a deliberate effort to do otherwise, humanity will probably warm Earth by 3 to 10 degrees by 2100, continuing beyond that, and that there would be some dire consequences. These would be really dire if we hit the upper end of that range at 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And then yesterday, I think we can summarize the gist of my message then as it really, whether, especially from a biblical perspective, it would be immoral to let that happen because this is God's earth, it is not ours. He has given it to us to be stewards of and to care for so that it will provide for future generations. And climate change is very much a long-term problem, and the damage we do will be long-lasting. So we have to keep these long perspectives in mind. Here's, just a real quick recap of the science. That's carbon dioxide from about AD 900 to the present. Very stable in the atmosphere at about 280 parts per million or 0.03% until we started burning fossil fuels, and then we see that dramatic increase. Finally, humans are affecting the Earth on a global scale, and we don't really know what the result of this experiment will be. But we do know that over the same, I skipped the temperature warming. So this is the projection to 2100 of temperature changes, somewhere between 3 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit, most likely somewhere more in the middle, more like 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And again, this is assuming that we do not make special policies to combat climate change. One of the most serious impacts would be global sea level rise, and as we'll see shortly, this figures prominently in the attitude of small island nations in climate change. This is a projection out 900 years, fairly simple calculation. The warming of the Earth melts the land ice, that's the red curve, long after carbon dioxide is stabilized in the atmosphere. This vertical line is the time, 70 years, from the beginning of the experiment, when carbon dioxide is stabilized, we get this very long-term warming of the oceans, which leads to sea level rise that goes on for 1,000 years and longer.
Question?
Yes.
How do you know that CO2 is stabilized? That's presuming.
No, this is it. Isaac, can you go back one? No, all right, just leave it. That is a simple experiment in which they allowed carbon dioxide to increase 1% per year for 70 years, at which time it doubles, and then they just keep it fixed. So it's just a thought experiment.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a computer modeling exercise of these different processes, assuming this very simple future of CO2.
Okay.
There we go.
Bill?
Yes?
What does that look like beyond the graph there?
Well, this line is sort of going at a fairly constant slope. So you project that out another 500 years, and you get another half meter of sea level rise. All right, let's go ahead. A quick summary of previous talks. Now I want to talk about policy goals and history. Go ahead. All right, a little science background on the issue that the negotiators were facing. We've got not just carbon dioxide, but all these other greenhouse gases. And what this diagram shows is how much each one has contributed to the so-called radiative forcing, or you can think of it as the greenhouse effect, so far. And so this is the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and how that affects our radiative input. Carbon dioxide is the big winner, but methane, even though there's much less of it, has about half the role of carbon dioxide. So methane is a very important greenhouse gas. Oh, thanks. Wow, you're fast. CFCs, those nasty chlorofluorocarbons that we phased out because of the ozone problem, those have contributed a lot, but that effect is actually diminishing as they die out of the atmosphere very slowly. Ozone, of course, is naturally occurring up in the stratosphere, and up there it's good because it shields us from ultraviolet light. But down in cities where it's produced unnaturally, it is very nasty. Ozone is very reactive, and in particular, it reacts with your lungs to make them not work very well anymore. There's a very direct correlation, and I should probably include this graph for better effect, very direct correlation between ozone exposure and loss of lung function. So ozone is nasty stuff. It's also a greenhouse gas when it's at the surface. It behaves differently in the stratosphere, and I can go into the details if anybody really wants to know. Nitrous oxide is another one. It's kind of down here, and then there are a whole bunch more below that. So the approach that has developed is to focus on a whole bunch of these gases, recognizing that they're all part of the package, and we have to think of them all together.
What is this measuring?
It's measuring what's called the... Nat, can you go back one? What's called the radiative forcing. So if you think of the troposphere as a system, so that's from roughly 10 miles above the Earth down to the surface, how much difference does the additional greenhouse gas make to that closed system? And the scientists draw it up there because it gets very complicated once you involve clouds.
So is that watts per?
Watts per square meter. So you can think of, 1.5 watts per square meter. That's like a Christmas light bulb, Christmas tree light bulb over every square meter. And that's roughly, and then you add all these up and then subtract some other things, and it comes out. It actually ends up that all the things you subtract cancel out everything else, and you end up with about 1.5 watts per square meter as the end result. Okay. All right, so where do these greenhouse gases come from? If we want to stop them going into the atmosphere, we have to know this. Well, carbon dioxide comes largely from burning fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, to provide energy. And I put energy in blue because it's a good thing. We need energy. There's no question about that. methane, and there are other things too, like cement production and deforestation and so on that produces CO2, but this is the large majority of it. Methane comes from anoxic decay, meaning decay that happens without oxygen, and it happens in rice paddies, ruminants, that's cows and other animals that have multiple stomachs. Turns out they digest their food anoxically, although they can do so oxically. I'm not sure that's the correct word. But anyway, the methane they produce is essentially wasted energy. It's hydrocarbons that could be going into protein that we either eat or drink, depending on whether it's a dairy cow or a beef cow. Landfills also produce methane. The crud that we put in there and pack down gets trapped down there away from air, and then it decays and it produces methane. Swampy or boggy land, this is naturally occurring, of course, but we also sometimes make swamps or other wet areas, and so this is all sort of bad stuff, so I put it in red. Chlorofluorocarbons were used as refrigerants. They were used in every refrigerator manufactured between about 1930 and the late 1980s, early 1990s. They were also used as spray can propellants. You probably remember that that whole thing about don't use aerosol cans because they deplete the ozone layer. That public message stayed in the consciousness about 10 years after CFCs were actually phased out. So people were avoiding aerosol spray cans long after they were no longer containing CFCs. Anyway, they're also used as cleansers in the manufacture of semiconductors and other things, but they're no longer produced. Yay. They have essentially been phased out because of concern about the ozone layer. And I'll come back to that later because it's an important part of our policy history here. Yeah.
What's CFC?
It stands for chlorofluorocarbons. They're molecules that have different combinations of carbon, chlorine, and fluorine in them. And then finally, ozone in the troposphere is produced by urban pollution, so that's a bad thing, and we would be happy if we could eliminate that because it would eliminate, it would be a nice thing to eliminate in its own right, quite apart from climate change stuff. Okay.
Two questions.
Yes.
What do they use in the propellants and cans nowadays?
One of the nice things about CFCs were that they were non-toxic because they didn't react chemically. They were non-flammable, and they were basically harmless, therefore. They now use various other compounds, many of which are flammable. So if you use a spray can, it probably has a big label on it saying, you know, do not smoke while you're using this product. I remember in college we used to use these things to incinerate cockroaches. get the can of Lysol, there's another cockroach. So we have the ozone layer to thank for that. One equation, okay, I think I showed one equation a little while earlier. This, if anybody have calculus? Remember calculus? Okay. Well, this is just saying carbon, the rate of change of carbon, so how fast carbon accumulates, is a function of several things multiplied together and one little thing subtracted. The P stands for global population. The dollars over P means how rich all those people are. Or more precisely, how much economic activity they produce every year. E over dollars means how much energy it takes to produce that dollar of productivity. Or you can think of that as the energy efficiency. And this last term multiplied here, EC over E, is the fraction of energy that comes from carbon-producing sources. The S is sinks. So these things all multiplied together tell you how much the humans are putting into the air, and S is how much nature, and possibly with our help, is taking carbon out of the air. I'm focusing on carbon because it's the main greenhouse gas, but there are analogous things for the other gases. So if we wanted to make this number, the rate of accumulation of carbon dioxide, go down, we would have to either reduce population growth, or reduce economic growth, or increase energy efficiency, or switch to renewables. So these four are all the human side of it. Or we would have to increase sinks. Yes?
What do you mean by sinks?
Okay, a sink, thank you. This is a term that seems so obvious that I forget that not everybody has had a lot of chemistry. A sink is something that a quantity goes into. So just like when you brush your teeth, the toothpaste and the water goes into the sink and down the drain. So you can think of it as a drain for carbon. In this case, the main sinks are forests and the ocean, which are sucking up CO2. Okay, can you hit that button? I think we've got a little animation effect here. Oh no, that was, okay, that's a different one. All right, now I want to go into a little bit of history now that we've had a little sort of science lesson. If you've been following the news, you probably know that the Senate rejected an increase in the CAFE standards. These are the fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. They were initially introduced as a result of the oil shocks, oil price shocks in the 1970s. They have not been changed since then. The Senate also, around the same time, rejected drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So it was sort of a quid pro quo. We don't get progress on this, which would be a great thing, but we didn't do this bad thing. Okay, now, next. So another thing, the lobbyists for coal and oil industries trying to discredit the science. The Bush administration basically accepts the science of climate change. The best scientific information indicates that significant changes in the climate system are likely. And the Bush policy, voluntary emissions reductions with vague goals. Okay, so you've been following the news?
Yes.
This was actually 1992. And we're right back there again. All of these things happened both in 1992 and in 2002. So how on earth could we squander 10 years? And when I speak of we, I mean primarily the U.S., but it is a global effort that I'm describing. And by the way, this came from that book that I've been plugging, The Carbon War by Jeremy Lake, which is now sold out. So if you want it, you'll have to get it at home. All right, in 1992, after several years of negotiations in which the U.S. under Bush 1 was really putting the brakes on any kind of international treaty on climate change, finally under pressure, they conceded to sign a treaty that had this language in it. The goal of the Framework Convention on Climate Change was, quote, to stabilize the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at a level that will prevent dangerous human interference with the climate system. This was, in a sense, a remarkable milestone because it recognized, number one, that eventually greenhouse gases really should be stabilized. Number two, it recognized that there was a point at which we could consider human interference to be dangerous. Now the problem is that no scientist, or at least not very many of them, will tell you what that level is. And Paul O'Neill, Treasury Secretary, who I quoted on Monday, has said, look, if you guys will just give us a number, we'll shoot for it. But no scientist, or not very many, not enough, are willing to say, I think it's 400 parts per million. We'll be there in 6 years. Or I think it's 450. All right, but there's this notion of stabilization. Unfortunately, the Framework Convention as a whole had no teeth to it. It was just a set of voluntary targets. And again, that was primarily the Bush administration. The Europeans were strongly pushing for emissions targets.
Bill?
Yes?
Can you talk a little bit more about why it's so hard to come up with a recommended amendment?
Well, it's hard to think about the whole world and decide at what level dangerous things happen.
But it's lower than higher.
I think we're there already. You know, we're seeing huge changes in the Arctic. We're seeing coral bleaching. We're seeing possible large increases in certain kinds of extreme weather, although that's very speculative. Yeah. There are a lot of possible, clues that you can say, well, it's already getting dangerous on a small scale. Do we wait until most countries in the world are saying, okay, enough?
No, we don't want to.
What I want to go through here is the sort of time scale that we're talking about to stabilize. All right, so what's shown here is the annual emissions in gigatons of carbon. You don't need to know how many that is. It's just a big number. This white line shows the last half century. So rising pretty steadily except for the oil crunch of the early 70s when things leveled out briefly. But fairly steady march upward. And you can see that if you extrapolate, we get up to about 14, a doubling of the emissions rate in about 50 years. So let's see some different stabilization scenarios. Just hit it repeatedly. So this is if we want to stabilize at 750 parts per million. That's roughly three times present, a little less than three times pre-industrial values. About twice where we are now. And you see that fairly soon, like within the next 20 years, we'll have to start leveling off the rate of increase of emissions. Not stabilizing emissions, but leveling off. And then by about 2050, we would have to kind of reach the maximum emissions and then start coming down. And eventually, we'd have to get down to very low levels of emissions to stabilize. Okay, just hit it repeatedly for the rest of them, okay? So the same thing for 650, just keep hitting it, please. 550 and 450, okay? 450 is a pretty low number considering we're now at 380. And you can see that we really don't have much time left to cap emissions. And in fact, we would have to start pretty much now along that road to get to 450. And whatever number we choose, the lower it is, the sooner we have to cap emissions, and the lower we'll eventually have to take emissions. So think about, and we're looking out here to 2250. Think about having a 23rd century economy using the same amount of energy that we used in 1950, with probably three times as many people on the planet as there were there. So this is a big, challenging goal. Okay, CO2, where has it come from? This is a nice graphic put together by Time in its article on climate change last year. And it shows, as the size of the smoke plume, this total CO2 emissions since 1950 for each of the major emitters. The USA is number one by a very long shot. Number two is Russia. The European Union collectively is 128 of these units. So you see their plume is much shorter. And then you get down to China and some of the former Soviet republics. India is way down here, Japan. So if you think about the climate change problem, who did it? Who created it? It's the industrialized world. 80% of the unnatural CO2 that's up there came from the 20% of us who live in the developed world. Important fact. The colors on these countries indicate their current per capita annual emissions, how much they are putting into the atmosphere now. Okay? So again, USA is number one. Look who's number two. Australia. The European countries, you can see the scale over here, red is big and tall, and then it goes down. Europe and the former Soviet Union and a couple of African countries, Egypt and I think that's Libya, are up there, and South Africa, okay, and Canada. But all of those are emitting less per person than we are. And then you get down to the developed world, which is in yellows and greens, most of Africa, South America, South Asia. So let's, and I could show you more details of this, but I think this gives you a picture of who did it and who is doing it. Next, please. this is another perspective on the same question. Total world emissions in 1995, the USA was responsible for 22% of global emissions, so more than a fifth, single-handedly. The developing world collectively, this is about 5 billion people, is 27%, so just slightly more than the US. By 2035, it's projected that the developing world will be responsible for 50% of emissions because of rapid economic growth, primarily in China and India, which is falls under this other Asia category. So, as we look now at the perspectives that different nations have, keep these two graphs in mind. So, let's go to the next slide. Various perspectives. The U.S. says, well, we look ahead and the developing countries are going to be a huge part of the future emissions. So they really should participate. Now the U.S. also has this view articulated that any solutions to climate change must not harm our economy. They have to be free.
Yes.
Okay. The developing countries say, are you crazy? You caused the problem. You take the first step, and then if we see that you're serious, then we'll step in and participate. Okay. Europe says, oh boy, those Americans are immorally profligate in their use of energy. They should really go for some deeper reductions. And until the US withdrew from this international process, the Europeans were really badgering the Americans not to get out of their commitments by what's called emissions trading. I'll come to emissions trading in a minute. But Europeans really have this bee in their bonnet about the morality of U.S. because they say, well, look, we're living in, you know, nice houses and we have a second home down in the Côte d'Azur, and yet we do all this with half the per capita emissions that you do. So why don't you just become like us? Okay, let's go down. OPEC, the oil-producing and exporting countries, say, climate change? What climate change? They have been stoutly resisting any kind of treaty unless it would have, you know, virtually no teeth in it. And then the Alliance of Small Island States say, you solve this problem now. We're looking at going out of existence. You can't mess around with, well, it might cost, you know, this or that. Just solve it. And AOSIS and the developing countries, they come to these meetings and these international meetings, and they get passionate because their future is at stake. And they just can't understand how anybody could be so uncaring as to quibble about whether we should reduce by 1% or 2%. Okay, so that's the background for the different perspectives that come to this international negotiation. It was recognized in the 1980s that some kind of international agreement would be needed because this was such a huge issue. It would not be easy for one country to unilaterally take some steps. Already in the 1970s, there was growing concern about both ozone depletion and climate change. Ozone comes into our story here because in some ways it was a dry run for climate change, policy-wise. In the 1980s, the Montreal Protocol, 1985, it was negotiated. It was an effective policy to begin chipping away at production of chlorofluorocarbons. It initially involved just a few countries, just a few gases, and on a very unambitious timetable for small reductions. But in a series of amendments, the level of emissions was drastically reduced, the number of countries involved drastically increased, and the number of gases involved drastically increased. So it was this very rapid ramping up of the goals. It was accelerated by the discovery of the ozone hole in 1985. The negotiations were already underway, but when scientists discovered, boy, there's an ozone hole over Antarctica, we have no idea why it's there, this really gave force to policymakers to get somewhere. Then we had the Framework Convention, which I quoted, after many years of negotiations, and all it came up with was voluntary emissions reductions and an annual conference of the parties. So they agreed to get together every year and just sort of talk about what was going on. Within a couple years, it became apparent that this was not going to be enough, that these voluntary emissions reductions weren't getting anywhere. And furthermore, the Clinton administration came into power in 1993 and really sort of tipped the balance back in favor of solid targets. So they spent several years negotiating terms under which nations could agree to begin actually working to reduce emissions instead of just saying, well, we might have some vague goals. And that resulted in the Kyoto Protocol, which has binding reductions. And I'll describe the terms of the Kyoto Protocol in a minute. Did you have a question? Okay. All right. Quick comparison of Montreal and Kyoto. Montreal really provided a template for Kyoto. And that was unfortunate because they're vastly different problems. CFCs were produced by a few companies. There was a group of those companies meeting in a technological assessment of the feasibility of phasing out CFCs, and they were competing with each other to come up with a way to do it. And once the companies got that momentum, it happened really fast. It was possible, and so they phased it out. CO2, very different. It's much more pervasive in the economy. It's not easy to just come up with a substitute and switch to it in a couple of years. But this is the similarity. Targets and timetables was the approach that was taken. We're going to try to reduce by X amount by this date. Broad then deep. You start by involving more and more countries, and then you go for deeper reductions. That was the idea of Kyoto. You would start with this very unambitious target. Well, at the time, it seemed unambitious. And I'll come to that in a minute. Then you go for more nations, and then you go for deeper cuts. Common but differentiated responsibilities. This was something that President Bush the first signed in the Framework Convention on Climate Change. There was this notion that all countries should be involved, but the developed world should take the first step. That was inherent in the Framework Convention in 1992. There's also this focus on monitoring emissions, which is easy if you're selling CFCs. It's very hard if you're selling products that produce carbon dioxide. You can add that up, but what you can't add up very easily are the sinks. It's incredibly difficult to measure how much your forest management is absorbing carbon into the trees and the soil. One engineer told me that if you want to measure the amount of carbon in the soil, there are all these different instruments you can stick into the ground, but and they sort of vaporize a little bit of dirt around them and they measure the carbon. But you could go 6 inches away and get a reading that's different by a factor of 2 because you hit a decayed tree root. And he said, really, the only way to measure it is to go in there with a front end loader and scoop up a couple cubic meters and then measure all the carbon in that. So when you start talking about trying to measure how much carbon dioxide is coming out of the air, which the Kyoto Protocol does, it becomes virtually unenforceable. But that's what we now have. So let's see the details of Kyoto. They did come up with binding emissions targets for developed nations. The European Union, their goal is 8% below 1990 emissions. The US, 7%. Japan, 6%, because their economy is already so efficient. The Europeans, because they wanted to lead the way. Several countries in 1992 were pushing for a cut of 15 or 20% below 1990 levels, which was, of course, that was 1992, and then this was 97. The targets are to be reached over a so-called commitment period. That's an average from 2008 to 2012, 5 years emissions averaged together. If you make your goal over that year, then you've satisfied your obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. It did not just focus on CO2, it recognized that chart that I first showed you about carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide and ozone precursors, CFCs. They're all included, so, and they're weighted by how important they are on that scale, roughly. So if you reduce methane by this amount, you get credit for that equivalent amount of carbon dioxide. So it's a total approach. It also includes carbon sequestration. This was something the Clinton administration was really pushing for because it would make it easier to sell in the U.S. Also, emissions trading. In other words, if another country, say Kazakhstan, reduces their emissions more, then they'll have credits to sell to us. And believe me, it's cheaper to reduce emissions in Kazakhstan, where all the apartment buildings have central heating with no thermostats in the rooms, and if people are hot in the winter, they open their windows. You put $1 million into Kazakhstan and you get much more emissions reductions than you would if you tried to do it in the US. So emissions trading is a way to do it cheaper. And that was a good thing to include, but the thing that the Europeans really got annoyed about was the Americans said, well, we ought to be able to reduce all our emissions through trading, and Europeans wanted us to feel the pain because, as I said, they thought we were morally wrong to be taking this approach. So they really wanted us to meet as little as possible of our reductions through trading. So where do we stand with the Kyoto Protocol? Well, Europe and Japan have, just in the last few months, ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and it is very close to having enough nations to enter into force. And in a couple of weeks, you'll start hearing about a big summit on sustainable development in Johannesburg, South Africa, and that will be an opportunity for more nations to ratify it, and it will probably enter into force around then. As you probably heard, George Bush withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol, despite the fact that George Bush first had signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which led to the Kyoto Protocol. President Clinton had signed the Kyoto Protocol, but he knew that he could not get it past the Senate because the Senate said, this only includes developed nations, no dice. Gotta have developing countries in on the first go. And the Senate, in fact, and the House spent much of the 1990s waging war on the Clinton administration over anything that looked like an attempt to implement Kyoto without ratification. This included energy efficiency moves that would have saved the government billions of dollars. They were routinely voted down because it looked sort of like implementing Kyoto. This included any kind of support for renewable energy, any kind of support for improved fuel efficiency. Congress repeatedly said no to these things because it looked like Kyoto. And they had said, we don't want Kyoto because it doesn't include developing countries. So that's the Kyoto Protocol.
Question?
Yes.
What's the forest provision?
Can you go up? Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Can you go back one there? Yeah, the idea of sequestration is, if you remember that equation with the S on the back, it sinks. The U.S. said, if we spend money by not harvesting timber that we would otherwise have harvested, we ought to get credit for the additional carbon storage that that forest provides, because it's taking carbon out of the atmosphere as long as it's growing. And which sounds good. The problem is the implementation, the monitoring, because much of the carbon is stored in the soil, and I already said how hard it is to monitor that. It's also very difficult to define whether you're actually doing this for climate reasons. For example, in the Northwest here, we've in recent years had many salmon species listed as endangered. And that's changed land use dramatically, especially around rivers. So in riparian zones, it's no longer allowed for timber companies to harvest trees. They have to leave them there for the salmon. Well, they can't get credit for that because they're doing it for salmon. They're not, you have to do something on top of what was otherwise required for it to count under this. So, you can see why negotiators end up spending weeks defining sequestration and things like that. It's very, very messy. The scientific principle is good, but it just ends up being really hard.
Do we know if young forests, for example, absorb more carbon than mature forests?
Yes. This has been another big debate in the Northwest. The timber companies say, well, now wait a minute. If you have an old growth forest, it's absorbing very little carbon each year. If you have a brand new forest, they're, you know, all those trees are growing by leaps and bounds. They're sucking carbon out of the air much faster. So obviously one solution to climate change is to cut all the old growth forest and replace it with second growth. The problem with that argument is that it only works if you make sure that every bit of carbon in those trees does not get into the atmosphere. And the only way to do that is to bury them. And nobody wants to cut down trees and bury them because it's a waste of money. When you mill lumber, a lot of that waste ends up getting burned, sawdust and so on, releases carbon dioxide. You can keep the timber, and as long as you know these old timbers stay here, they're not releasing carbon, but you've lost a lot of the carbon that's in trees. And what really matters is the storage. Yes.
Also, wouldn't cutting down old growth forests and then burying the trees, when they rotted, wouldn't that produce methane also?
Yes, I guess it would. You'd have to bury them deep enough that the methane couldn't leak out. Yes.
There's been some discussion about carbon neutral energies, raising trees and using them as a sole source versus coal.
Yes. That's a good point. If you can use carbon molecules that recently came out of the atmosphere as your energy source, that's much better than using the ones that came out of the atmosphere back when there were dinosaurs dying in the swamps. Yeah. Okay, let's see what the Kyoto Protocol would actually do. All right, we've already talked about how it's got these targets, so let's see what it actually looks like. This is how emissions are projected to rise from 2000 to 2010, business as usual. And this is what would happen if the Kyoto Protocol were enacted. So a very small reduction in emissions, partly because so few countries are involved, partly because the cuts are really not that deep. But let's look at what it would mean for the US. Okay, can you go to the next one? Let's see, is that what's next? Yes. Okay, US greenhouse gas emissions. Remember, Kyoto covers a bunch of gases. For the US, 82% of our greenhouse gas emissions are CO2. So our share of greenhouse gases are disproportionately coming from this one gas. Now, this is what it looks like for the US CO2 emissions. This is the projected business as usual. 1990 to 2000, our emissions grew about 15%. And from 2000 to 2010, they're projected to grow slightly more. The Kyoto Protocol, which is trying to get us down, remember, to 7% below 1990 levels, we'd have to do that. So, in effect, this is a dramatic reduction of about 30% compared to business as usual. This is why the Bush administration says Kyoto is too expensive. And in a way, they're right. It's expensive because we've waited so long to try to do anything. And so achieving those deep cuts can only be done with great cost. And it's also difficult to do because I forgot what the other thing I was going to say. Okay, so let's go on to the next thing. This is carbon intensity. So this is the amount of carbon that we use to produce a dollar of GDP. And if we take 1990 units as 100, we reduced carbon intensity by about 12%. Sorry, about 17% in the 1990s. So we got more efficient. And it's projected that over the next 10 years, we would get about another 14% more efficient. That's the black curve. Now, when Bush came out with his climate change action plan last spring, after rejecting the Kyoto Protocol, he said he would come up with something new. He said 18% reduction in carbon intensity, which sounded good. And at first I thought, oh, yay. And then I thought, I've seen those graphs of carbon intensity. I've seen that it's already dropped. How much are they expecting it will drop? Well, in fact, 18% is only a couple percent below the projected business as usual. So this is really no action at all. This is sort of hoping that people will do a few extra things that they wouldn't otherwise do.
And what are some of those things? How have we achieved this?
This is primarily being achieved by large businesses investing in energy efficient equipment in factories.
So even though
it pays for them
to
do
that. We're using more energy, but we're using it.
Yeah, and that's happening also in new homes. You know, new homes are more efficient than old homes, but much of this change is in the industrial sector. It's definitely not in the transportation sector, and it's only marginally in the residential sector. So the industry has been doing the heavy lifting here, and Bush essentially said this was a voluntary plan, it's for businesses to do. It makes economic sense for them to make those investments. Mm-hmm. They'll continue making it, and he's sort of hoping that that they'll be worried enough about future vigorous action that they'll take just enough to slide by, enough extra.
Just a question on that. Wouldn't also your economic mix of service sector type GDP production versus manufacturing have an effect there if your service sector economy is moving in that direction?
That's true.
Or technology versus heavy industry.
Yeah. And at one point, since you mentioned that, some lobbyists from the coal industry went to Congress and said, look, the internet boom is a huge driver in our electricity use. So because of the internet, we have to keep burning coal because we have this huge demand. It turned out they were really fudging the numbers. A computer sitting on your desktop doesn't use a whole lot of energy. I mean, server farms do, but per capita, they're not a big source of consumption. Okay, let's go on. All right, so now I've sort of taken you through the policy goals and history. This attempt to get the world to cooperate on approach, guided by the experience in the Montreal Protocol, we ended up with this really difficult, unworkable treaty that Europe and Japan have ratified, and they're going to discover in the next 6 years just how difficult it is to implement and meet those targets. And I'm fairly sure they will fail to meet those targets. And the sad thing is that 2012 will roll around, and we'll be right back where we were in 1992 with very little reduction in emissions and a failed attempt at a policy, which is really very sad. Now I want to talk about economic analyses that are part and parcel of the resistance to change that has been so prevalent in the United States. First, a few words about these economic analyses. The Kyoto Protocol and these huge international agreements and the whole issue of climate change are far beyond any previous experience that economists have. They had done, some large-scale, national-scale analysis about environmental issues, but this is so far-reaching, so pervasive, so long time-scale, there's just no way for economics to come to grips with this using their usual tools. One of the main tools they use, of course, is cost-benefit analysis. A company is considering making a decision or an investment. They do a cost-benefit analysis, and that guides the decision. It doesn't always make the decision, but it certainly guides it. But when we talk about a decision like, do we try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, this cost-benefit analysis fails in several ways. First of all, it ignores externalities. It tends to focus on what the actual economic costs would be. And it ignores the things that are external to that cost calculation. For example, what is the value of having polar bears exist as a species? Can we put a dollar value on that and put it in our equation? No. What is the value of having 10,000 people in Honduras not get wiped out by a hurricane in 2035 that happened because of climate change? Can we put that in the equation? No. So there are a number of things that are external to the economic calculation, but which we nonetheless would generally consider as having some value. The second shortcoming is that cost-benefit analysis uses something called discount rates. If you're a company and you're thinking about investing $10 million next year, and the payoff is going to come 5 years down the road, you want to be able to compare the size of the payoff at some later date with the size of the outlay. And so you think, well, if I put that money in the bank, it would earn 5% interest. Well, not these days. 2% interest, if you're lucky. And so you automatically assign this sort of interest rate to the money. Well, when we start talking about climate change and something that's 40 years out, let's suppose there's something that we could put a cost on then, like the 10,000 lives lost in Honduras. Well, do we put an interest rate on lives? You know, are 10,000 lives lost in 2035 equal to 5,000 lives lost next year? How do we do that calculation? This whole idea of a discount rate essentially means that when we borrow from the future, that's a fair thing to do. And there's a real moral problem with that. The third thing that shows that cost-benefit analysis really is not up to the task is that it has no good way to deal with low-probability, high-risk outcomes. Some of these things that you sometimes hear about climate change are very unlikely, according to scientists. But if they did happen, they would be so bad that we really wouldn't want to allow that they might happen. For example, a huge increase in hurricanes making landfall. At this point, the science can't say whether that's likely, but it's a possibility, and that would be a really bad thing to leave for future generations. So how do we factor that into a cost-benefit analysis? We can't. Okay. With that background, there have nonetheless been a lot of studies talking about the costs of implementing Kyoto. Most studies come in at 0.2 to 2% of gross domestic product for developed countries without emissions trading. In other words, if they have to do it domestically. If they're allowed to do all of their reductions through emissions trading, that cuts the cost by a factor of 2. But notice there's a factor of 10 uncertainty in these calculations. So this is a huge uncertainty. Just for perspective, defense spending is now, for the U.S., it's about 3.5% of gross domestic product. And entitlements, that's primarily Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are 12% of GDP. So when we talk about, you know, numbers up to 1%, I mean, this is not small change. But if we think about down at this low end, well, 0.1% of GDP, that's not too bad. It's not that huge. That's $10 billion a year. No. And we paid the airlines how much after September 11th? 40 billion, something like that. Okay, but sometimes you hear economic analysis coming up with something more like 4% of GDP and talk of millions of jobs lost if we do anything about climate change. Anybody want to guess who's paying for these economic studies? Coal industry. They're the ones who are most scared. The oil industry too. Okay, well, turns out if you scratch below the surface and you see what assumptions go into these calculations, you have to assume, number one, that there's no alternative to fossil fuel. In other words, if you want to cut your emissions by 30%, it means you have to cut your consumption by 30% simply by driving less and using less electricity, and that automatically drives a huge reduction in economic activity. Never mind that if this actually happened, people would go out and buy other sources somehow. You know, you'd buy more fuel-efficient cars, you'd buy more fuel-efficient equipment, you'd switch to other sources of energy. Second is, it does not factor in the benefit side. It's only looking at the cost side. Reduced air pollution, for example, if you implemented plans in cities to rapidly increase mass transit using electric buses, you would have a huge reduction in air pollution, and that would have a real economic benefit in terms of healthcare costs. The third thing is that you achieve this reduction through huge carbon taxes, which just sort of vanish into that evil government bureaucracy that takes all our money. Most policymakers who have worked on this say, well, if we implement a carbon tax, that money will be used to reduce other taxes, especially regressive taxes like payroll tax, which funds Social Security. If you plow the money back in that way, this number automatically drops dramatically. And then the fourth is, again, all the reductions happen domestically. There's no emissions trading. In other words, if we set out to do this as dumb as possible, yeah, it might cost that much. And maybe we could find a bunch of policymakers who would go for that.
But, I bet you
could. I think even the Democrats are smart enough not to go for that. Okay, let's move on. All right, here's a great example of how well these economic models have done in the past. In 1990, the Clean Air Act was up for amendments, and the industry was predicting job losses in the hundreds of thousands, 200,000, 300,000. The actual job losses spread over many states over several years were 7,000. So these economic models are, maybe they're useful toys, but in the wrong hands, they can really scare people into inaction, and that's a shame. The source of this is a really nice book called The Trade-Off Myth, Fact and Fiction About Jobs and the Environment by Eben Goodstein, an economist at Lewis and Clark College of Portland. Really nice book, easy read. Okay, I've talked about cost-benefit. Let's at least do the exercise. All right. Here are some costs of climate change, of addressing climate change, stopping it. Obviously, we'd have higher energy prices. We would have to. We would therefore have reduced consumption. If it costs more to get the goods to market, then you're going to buy less. That's absolutely true. There will certainly be many lost jobs, especially in the coal, auto, and oil industries. There are definitely some costs, but let's look at some benefits. Reduced air pollution, which I already said, would have a huge economic benefit, and of course there's the non-economic benefit to human health. Avoided damages. This is a fairly simple way of saying all those bad things that I described on Wednesday wouldn't happen as much and as often and as bad. And, you know, it's pretty hard to estimate what that would be, let alone throw it into an equation. But clearly there would be a lot of avoided damages. And of course there would be a lot of new jobs, as happened with the Clean Air Act. When we enact environmental legislation, and this is even Goodstein's point, we destroy old jobs, but we create new jobs. And the new job creation has generally exceeded the old job loss. And there are now so few people employed in the coal industry because it's so mechanized, that if we spent the same amount of money insulating buildings, which is a very labor-intensive process, you would put something like 7 people to work for every job lost in the fossil industries. Okay. The problem is that these industries, some of them don't exist yet, but the ones that do can't match these industries for lobbying clout. There's just no match. So instead, we end up relying on concerned citizens and environmental groups to push this. All right, so you decide, costs and benefits, which outweighs the other? Question?
I was just going to say, I think one benefit is that other countries are going to implement the Kyoto Protocol and stuff. So we're going to lose out on technology that Germany and Japan come up with.
Excellent point.
That would be a benefit for us.
It's already happened. Germany has overtaken us as the main manufacturer of wind, wind farms, whatever they're called, power plants. And that's bound to happen in other industries as well. Yes?
Aren't all these oil industry people going to lose their jobs when we run out of oil anyway?
Yes, but they think that's still pretty far out in the future. The current prediction the oil industry doesn't like to say this, but people who watch it say global production will probably peak somewhere around 2015. The current rate of discovery of new oil is 6 billion barrels a day. The current rate of consumption of oil is 28 billion barrels a day. New discovery peaked in the early 1960s, before I was born. And it's been on the decline ever since. So it's pretty clear that by the time we get to that peak in production, even if it's in 2025, the prices will be rising fairly dramatically. But after that, it'll still take a long time to pump it all out of the ground. And coal has hundreds of years left. If we burned all the coal, we would send CO2 up to level 7 times pre-industrial, up to something like 1,000 parts per million. So that's, or more. So that's really, really, really big. Yes?
You didn't mention anything about the air quality and how it affects, causes asthma and a lot of lung diseases.
Yeah, that was all wrapped in this sort of air pollution thing. There are a lot of products of combustion, not just ozone, that do damage human health, especially in cities. And they also damage crops and forests and so on, reduce productivity there as well.
Because I'm hearing that in some cities, the rate of asthma in children is way up.
And this is partly because of ozone, but there are also other pollutants involved. So, if we tackled those, it wouldn't just be CO2 we'd be going after. We'd have less ozone, we'd have less particulates, and it would be better, especially for the children. Let's wrap up here. So, here's my question. Okay.
The coal industry uses the term clean coal.
Yes. Now. Lovely term, isn't it? That's like diet soda or something.
Does clean mean anything in terms of reduction of CO2? Or are they just?
No, it refers to the sulfur content.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my rosy last slide to lead into tomorrow. The key challenge is to identify mitigation options, that means ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, that simultaneously address local and regional environmental and development issues, as well as climate change. In other words, let's start by going after the things that meet other goals of reducing air pollution, improving traffic flow, and things like that. And if we simply do those, we'll be in a much better position to start making the difficult cuts as we transition away from fossil fuels. And tomorrow, I will describe how that can happen. So that's all I have tonight. Good job.